Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, and he's David Taylor. You haven't heard from us for a little bit. We took a bit of a break because we needed to get on with other responsibilities, but also because I thought we were done, David. I thought we'd eliminated, vanquished our foes on the field of podcast inquiry. We did a couple of episodes a while back on cultural Marxism, and I thought we kind of, you know, we kind of put the sword to this whole cultural Marxism malarkey. Turns out we didn't, which raises the question, David, have I been thinking that our influence, dozens of people, is not quite enough?
Yeah, I blame the listenership. They're not evangelizing the message of Eucatastrophe well enough, especially to the Christian alt-right.
Yes.
Although Nathan Campbell often engages in all sorts of online discussion, trying to moderate some nonsense.
I mean, that's Nathan Campbell, everyone, the Don Quixote of Queensland. Here we go.
That's something for your LinkedIn.
Anyway, cultural Marxism is kind of relevant because for those people who think this is the, the basket of deplorables for everything that is wrong with society at the moment, we're going to be talking about where, for them, this all emanates from, namely the university. We're going to do three episodes actually on this, a bit of a trilogy. The first one, we're going to look at the purpose of the university. Is it for utility or is it for the pursuit of knowledge, as a contrast there? And the second episode, we are going to look at the relevance of theology to an integrated knowledge within any form of education. And in the third, we are going to reveal it was the Emperor all along, and that every ship is a Death Star, and that Rey is actually Rey Skywalker. and then we're going to cry a little. No, for the third, what we're actually going to do is we're going to look at the church and the university, and we're going to look at this through the prism of the vocation of a student who is a Christian and what we think should be there for that vocation. So in this episode, as I said, we're going to look at the purpose of the university. Now, why does this arise at this present time? Well, we're in the middle of a pandemic, as we know, and this has meant that there's going to be a potential fundamental restructuring of our universities with severe job losses, most likely, in the event that international student income continues to decline. This has been married up with the federal government in Australia refusing to provide JobKeeper support to those in the university. And then most recently, in order to kick the puppy while it's down, the federal government made its proposals regarding funding of universities. Now, these proposals can essentially be summarized as part of a steady decline in state funding for universities in Australia. And as a byline, these proposals would mean a cut of around 15% per domestic student for funding to universities. It's a bit strange in Australia, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, or you'd find it strange if you're not in Australia perhaps, that the way it's funded universities is the government makes a contribution itself, and then the student makes their contribution. And that student contribution, their fee, is typically paid for through a government loan that they then pay back over time. Now, what the government is doing is it's increased the student cost of a degree in certain degree courses, like history. They've over doubled the cost of the degree for a student. Whereas in courses like engineering and nursing, for example, and in English, although you wonder whether the detail will be English taught as a second language, for example, the government is decreasing the required student contribution. Now, that sounds like an attack on the humanities, and in part it is, but ironically,
people that vote don't vote Coalition.
Right. Although if you go through the Coalition members themselves and look at their degrees, they're all have arts degrees. Yeah. Anyway, but if you look at the details, so for example, the government is decreasing student contribution to engineering, but it's also decreasing the government contribution. So it's demanding universities will take more students, supposedly, but in a less resourced degree, with the idea then being that maybe more students in history who are paying all this money would cross-subsidize, say, engineering. Now, underlying this, and it's a complete muddle of a policy package, But underlying it, the thread the government is putting forward is that they want to produce more job-ready graduates in areas of projected economic growth or need. And this is seen especially in light of the pandemic. Now, this idea of job-ready graduates made Dave go on a bit of a Facebook rant. And then he said to me, let's go and read more cultural Marxism, Joel, because that's where my heart is. It's just been consumed by this wokeness of desire. No, he said, let's go read John Henry Newman, The Idea of a University, first written in 1852. Now, Newman, as you may know, was a 19th century English theologian, and he was first an Anglican priest, central to the Oxford movement. But he jumped the Tiber and became a Catholic and then a cardinal. And he was actually canonized by Pope Francis in October last year. Now, in this series of discourses and lectures that he gave on the idea of a university, Newman has two principal concerns. One is the relationship of theology, the necessary relationship of theology to the work of the university. And the second is what he develops as the purpose of the university in pursuing knowledge. Now, that first one about theology, we're going to park and put to next week. But this idea that the university is at its heart, its end, its purpose, is the pursuit of the unity of knowledge. Newman argues this against precisely the rhetoric of job-ready graduates. So he quotes Locke, John Locke, for this view. So this view that of job-ready graduates, which Newman identifies as utility, that the university must be useful. So Locke, for example, argued that students should be spending their time acquiring what might be useful to them, he said, as against their suffering and stuffing their heads with what Locke called a deal of trash. You know, probably the sort of stuff I do is a deal of trash, right? Now, in contrast to this, Newman argues the university exists for knowledge, what he also calls throughout this these discourses science of philosophy or enlargement or the disciplining of the intellect. Most broadly, you could think about this as the university existing for seeking and contemplating truth and undertaking the difficult task of integrating knowledge to find that truth. Now, so this is fascinating because he's writing in 1852 against utility as the heart of the university. And here we are in 2020 faced with a government that wants to focus on job-ready graduates. Yeah.
And it's worth pausing here for a moment to think a little bit more about this as a stream in Western thought. So he points to Locke, who, you know, is part of an important movement in this direction. But this question of the relationship between truth or inquiry or science or philosophy, whatever you call it, based on the different time, this relationship between truth and utility is one of the fundamental questions at the heart of the ongoing conversation that is the Western tradition. So if we think back to the Middle Ages with figures like Francis Bacon in the late Middle Ages. Bacon was someone who insisted that contemplation and pursuit of truth, it needs to be orientated towards the improvement of the lot of humanity. So he rejected this idea that truth was a good in itself to be pursued for its own sake, and instead saw truth and science as valuable for its ability to alleviate human misery and also to improve the human condition through things like overcoming the limitations of our senses through things like optics and things like that, there's all sorts of interesting developments there. Now, this is a big departure from a huge line of thought in the Western tradition around the objective of the pursuit of truth, that truth was fundamentally about, you know, moral formation and things like that. So this is a really important thing. And it's also coupled with another thread in the intellectual tradition, which is around this kind of deep skepticism that emerges at a similar time a skepticism towards kind of universal categories or universal unifying theories of all things. So if you think, you know, if you think very crudely about, so the Platonic idea of how you understand something, you understand a particular phenomena as a manifestation of a form of that thing that has a universal idea behind it. And with figures emerging like Ockham, or William of Ockham, in the Middle Ages, this thread emerges where we reject universal ideas and focus on individual phenomena. And that develops towards this idea that each unique individual phenomena has its own method of an inquiry that requires kind of specialist practice in order to fully understand it. So all of a sudden, you have this move away from a universalized understanding of the pursuit of truth towards an individualized and particularistic pursuit of truth, which, you know, develops, it comes to full fruition in our own day. So, and this is all to say, this is why I get so exasperated with talks of cultural Marxism, because the foundation to the cultural developments that we discuss actually are medieval. And they are actually connected with things that I think are also connected with the development of the religion that the people who talk about cultural Marxisms tend to have.
Yeah, so I think, another
episode.
But on that point, I think we said in our cultural Marxism episodes, the idea that the university is a hotbed of cultural Marxism just seems to completely mischaracterize how universities are actually experienced. But maybe we'll get to that. But yeah. I want to draw out two things from that illuminating points you just made. One is the Bacon point there really crystallizes a tension here. Because one thing in Newman that we'll come to discuss is that he sees the purpose as knowledge, integration of knowledge, development of an intellectual culture for the sake of knowledge. And he sees that as a good intrinsic in itself that can be in ways divorced from questions of virtue even. Certainly divorced from questions of their effect upon society for job readiness and those sorts of things, which he says can happen, but they're not the purpose of the university. Now, that raises the question whether Newman and this understanding of the university is in ways quite solipsistic. Yep. Does the university actually exist for something other than itself? You know, that's the question. And then the second point you're raising there about that rejecting of a unifying theory, right? Mm. That we need to then pass individual parcels of knowledge almost in a univocal way, right? We can analyze the plant as just the plant, not what the plant says about the cosmos, for example, right? Now, that is fascinating because that also tracks with, you know, a discourse of secularization.
Yep.
Because one discourse of secularization is not just the decline of religious belief, but as Weber puts it, the separation and differentiation of value spheres, politics, economics, religion, so on, right? In which each of these come to be understood as their own domain, exercising their own internal logic. Right, so politics or even political economy could be seen as for the sake of wealth creation or utility maximization. Economics, similarly, right? Religion, its own domain of belief. And so actually Newman in this idea of a university says, you know, we have a deep problem here because religion is now seen as feeling and sentiment. And so it's easily carved off and put to one side, right? But that specialization was also encouraged by emerging nation states because they wanted to invest into science, for example, economics and or cognate sort of fields because they were economically prosperous and productive.
Blow things up as well.
Exactly, yep. Right? And so actually what you're describing there is also a subordination of education to the state, yes. Which is, you know, crystallize, of course, in job-ready graduates, right? Yep. This is the subordination of education to the needs of state and market, right? Mm. So there's two points there. One is that specialization I want to focus on for a moment. Then the come to later is the question, is it too solipsistic to think of knowledge as the purpose of the university? But on that specialization, this is what Newman discusses as the character of education for the sake of utility. So he takes us in two directions. One is that he's critical of how this leads people to be essentially what you could say as credentialed but not educated. And this is actually a criticism I get from friends who actually work in education in other ways as well, is that they often say that they feel throughout primary, high school, and into tertiary, that we're creating a generation of people that are incredibly credentialed but not very educated, right?
Yeah.
And Newman describes us as persons who are full of information, men of information, he calls them. They have a vast multitude of information at their hands, but little sensibility about their relationship towards each other, right? You could think about this as almost crystallizing people on social media who are just sort of factoids, or just keep on repeating things that are drawn out of different news articles and so on, right? Now, this is also an internal criticism, right, to myself and others, because it is really quite a difficulty in our writing in university is that one thing we often do is we just kind of recapitulate work or various facts dressed in different ways because we have this publish or perish model, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
It's very difficult in the modern university to take time out to actually try and synthesize all these various components of knowledge, which is what he's saying needs to be the case. Now, he's also critical of specialization and its connections to utility because he thinks it means that a person will elevate their own narrow field as true, right?
Yeah.
As ultimately true. So he gives the example of a political economist who sees wealth maximization as the ends of all things because they are so honed in on wealth maximization. You could think about this with lawyers, right? How lawyers, we law academics, in some ways become like the philosophers of the now because we're all about rights discourse. And so we can actually colonize so much territory of political and philosophical discourse, right?
And like other fields like psychology are like this,
right.
Neuroscience and things like that.
Economics talking about the rational individual.
Yeah. We have the ultimate truth. Evolutionary psychology as an example of a kind of almost having a mythic status for our culture.
And we're stuck in it, right? Because, the development of the modern research university from like 19th century onwards is essentially this. You have to publish in a distinct field, both for economic gain, because then you get, more and more vaccines and that's a good thing.
Yep.
But at the same time, you then can actually show your body of work as a body of publications because you're not trying to integrate all forms of knowledge.
And I think in some of the more dubious areas of the academy, I think there's this sense in which the more specialized and niche your area is, the fewer people there are that have any knowledge sufficient to critique you. So you can kind of, and I've seen this happen in different areas, you can kind of get away with a lot if you've got an incredibly esoteric area of expertise, because who's going to write the paper to say that you're wrong?
Yeah. Or you could be like me and just take other people's theological work and just apply it in law and nobody will know the difference anyway. So maybe that's what I'm doing.
Or be like me and just sneer from the sidelines.
Okay. So I think though, just sticking to this utility point, because again, your point about that esoteric concern a person has raises the solipsism question, right? But the esoteric, but the point about specialization and utility, I think actually we could take this a bit further now in a contemporary vein. I think a lot of what we do, and this is not just in universities, but actually then education being continuous with politics, is we focus on technique. So we generally don't engage in a conversation about the ends of a good life. Instead, what we try and do is something like profitability, productivity, wealth maximization, generally for the ends of allowing people to pursue their individual plans and desires.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that we end up having a focus upon sort of levers of power and how we can manage them in order to maximize those things, right?
Yeah.
In order to gain more economic productivity or in order to emancipate people to pursue their own autonomous authenticity, for example. So we get this sort of marriage, and this is, again, education continuous with, I think, politics. You get this marriage between a kind of affirming of subjectivity of life plans and sort of a romantic, or dark romantic, as Milbeck and Pamps would put it, on a kind of somebody's desires and life plans with an objectivity and materialism and proceduralism. How do we use bureaucracies to further individual autonomy, for example, or economic productivity? How do we use science and the materialism that is there in order to do the same, right? And so this is kind of, you know, we've substituted out that conversation over what it means to live a good life for something like this, in which the point is to specialize in a particular field in order to exercise techniques of power.
Yeah, or quite simply to get your foot in the door in the job market,
right?
In a saturated job market where, you know, everybody is expected to have a tertiary education, and
which is fascinating, isn't it? Because what we end up doing is we end up teaching people techniques and routine. We kind of have this routine of education they go through in order to get into the job market, in which, you know, the point is to build your CV rather than to develop an integral understanding of the person, right?
Yeah.
But like at the same time, I have to say, like, my gosh, like it was hard enough when we went through university or when I did, but it's really hard on students now. Like the amount of jobs they have to hold down in order to get jobs and education at the same time. Yep. And there's something right as well. So this goes to our solipsism point, I think we should turn to. But there's something right in wanting a job, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
And because jobs are dignifying, right? And so Newman in The Idea of a University talks about, you know, that's not the point. In fact, he says the point is to cultivate the gentleman, he says. Now, immediately your hackles might start getting raised. He's writing in the 19th century, so you can understand what he's saying. But taken into now, you start thinking, well, actually, no, there's something dignifying about work. And we want to do, maybe we do want to prepare people for work, but we want to prepare them maybe in a different way to what was what may be the dominant discussion.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, couple of things to raise there. I mean, part of me also wants to just say, listen, like, give young people a bit of time, like, between having to fall into this kind of treadmill or grind to just get a job, get a mortgage, and, you know, live out the rest of your days. Give some people some time to actually experience things that are not useful in that sense. So, you know, just that university time is incredibly important for that.
I think this is fundamental, because one thing we do in the university, I think, I think we do it throughout all education, is that we inundate people with information, them, and then inundate them with assessments. I was sitting in an education innovation thing a while back. And
careful.
And someone put up on the slide their one, this is from someone outside of my area, put up on a slide one class they had for students and had seven assessments in that one class.
Yep.
And I asked, what's that about? And they said, oh, because we need to assess everything that's learned.
Units of competency and things like that.
And I went, oh my gosh, like imagine being a student with that mentality. That my knowledge production is just and affirming and extending is simply
You're not integrating what you're learning. You're working towards assessments.
One thing I'll say when we come to talking about student vocation as a Christian student is that they need to be reading full texts, right? And actually meditating and spending time.
Yeah.
But let's turn to directly into the solipsism.
Let me
set out what Newman says on this, right? So when he says that it is about integrating knowledge. That's why you need all these different disciplines so they can come together and cohere into what he calls a unity of knowledge. He says that's the point, right?
Yep.
And he says that there may be good things develop out of this, certain virtues, like you consult widely with other people, you listen, you respect other opinions, you have an intellectual curiosity, you value honesty. He goes on to say, you know, somebody who engages in this line of work will not have time essentially for bullshit, right?
Yeah.
You know, so there's certain supplementary virtues that, but he does say critically, you know, it is not integral to a virtuous life.
Yeah.
And the point is to create this intellectual culture in which knowledge is its own love, right?
Yeah.
He says its own desire for itself as a form of contemplation.
Yeah.
Now, solipsistic?
Like, yeah, so you can imagine that as something like preparing someone to enter society, or you could think about it as preparing someone to enter the salon in France or whatever its other European equivalent is, someone that can have that breadth of intellectual engagement. So, returning to Francis Bacon, so if we think about this point that all these lovely conversations about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, we're having these conversations at the time when there's actual human misery happening, where people are starving, where people are not housed properly and things like that. And people coming out of Bacon's tradition would say, you know, it's absurd to think that we should be wasting our time on these trivial intellectual pursuits and not focusing on the alleviation of suffering. And so in this sense, all this idea of, you know, in the classical world, the idea was, you know, you pursue truth so that you can conform your soul to that truth that you see there out in the cosmos. That was the fundamental kind of intellectual vocation. It's the pre-modern scientific vocation as well, that we pursue the order of nature so we can become ordered, well-ordered ourselves and things like that. And so I'm very sympathetic to that view, right? That it is this kind of luxury of a certain elite who don't have to worry about there being enough food on the table. But at the same time, I think that it might be kind of there might be a way of synthesizing these things, right? So if we rightly understand virtue, if we rightly understand the life of the mind and its relationship to virtue, and also virtue's relationship to love of the other and our neighbor, and particularly those that are vulnerable, these things start being shown to be in harmony. So if the pursuit of the life of the mind means that we will conform our souls to be rightly shaped, but then in the Christian kind of anthropological understanding, that a soul rightly formed is always oriented towards the good of the other, then I don't think that that pursuit of theory is a enemy of praxis, as you'd say in the tradition. Yes. I don't know. Those are some thoughts.
No, I think that's right. Like I think it's actually embedded there in Newman, despite what he actually says about, you know, contrasting it with virtue and so on. So you can get solipsistic accounts of this. So, you know, a critical view of something like Stanley Fisher's Save the World on Your Own Time, right?
Mm.
Which he says, you know, we shouldn't be used for political agendas. I in part agree with that, right?
Yeah.
I in part agree because I think you can instrumentalize the university in various ways, both instrumentalizing it as a kind of welfare agency when it's just not designed for that, yep, or instrumentalizing it for a particular political vantage, right? So I find it curious at the moment in universities how there's often courses on advocacy and protest, right? Not yep. courses about history of it, not courses about justice and the nature of it and theorizing and talking about it, but courses on the techniques
yep.
of that, right? And that seems to me to be something that is just, it's just outside of what a university probably would be doing. It can talk about justice, and then, you know, if you want to use that for your techniques of advocacy and so on, go ahead. Anyway, but like, your point, I think, is the critical one. And it, and as I said, I think it's there in Newman as well. So take it as an example. If you are concerned with a unity of knowledge, you know, you'd ask the question, what is a person?
Mm.
And you may bring to bear upon that various sciences. And you may bring to bear upon that literature, poetry, and certainly the theological question that you were just raising, right? Mm. And then that question, what is a person, can't be answered without an understanding of that person in relationship. So how the person is formed by society, how the person contributes to a society through their obligations and duties, and how that society then shapes who that person is, right? And so the question, what is a person, is always framed with reference to what kind of society do we want to live in? And I think this is the continuity of a certain virtue discourse, right? That you can't actually have that theoretical reflection without an understanding of that this is also politics. And I don't mean politics in like a partisan, et cetera. I mean politics as in the formation of a people, right? And so I think that that there is, there, and that is, in fact, I think also there in Newman, despite him saying that it's not about virtue and so on. He does talk about, you know, those intellectual virtues of honesty and so on. He does talk about how you are forming a community of people. He does talk about how that intellectual culture then shapes, can shape a society and so on. And I think that's right. Like that is to me the purpose then for education. We wouldn't think of it as just simply, oh, I seek knowledge in the way of like an esoteric concern.
Yep.
That is mine, and you know, lucky me, I've got tenure, I can do what I want sort of thing.
Yep.
But actually, I seek knowledge because I'm engaging in a sustained interrogation about what is the life that is worth living.
Yeah. Right? And I would just add very quickly as well that in my own personal experience, so I was someone that never expected to go to university growing up. I didn't finish high school. I left kind of school kind of in a sub-working class mess of a situation, but was always intrigued by conversations I'd overhear from friends who went to university, and I was really interested in what they were studying. And eventually I got the opportunity to go to university through doing a bridging course on the history of ideas, which then got me into a Bachelor of Arts in my mid-20s. And coming from my background, I found engaging in philosophy incredibly emancipatory. And it wasn't for the economic opportunities that it afforded me, Lord knows. It was actually just engaging with this realm of ideas was personally and spiritually liberating. It gave me this sense that even with nothing, I still had the pursuit of truth. And that might sound very strange to a lot of people, but nonetheless, like the pursuit of truth itself, I found politically and morally liberating. And so I don't think we need to engage in this bargain between love of truth and utility, or love of truth and liberation,
or
love of truth and politics.
Newman says that ultimately that love of truth and knowledge is useful, but he means it useful in the deepest sense, that it is of gift.
Yeah.
That it is a gift and it is of benefit to the person, right? That it is a blessing. Right. And I think what you're describing there in part is that you fell in love with particular thinkers, traditions and ways of thinking and so on.
Mm.
And that became like a lifelong vocation.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And that's kind of what you want to inspire in a student. And I think actually most university academics, that's what we go in with as a latent understanding of what we're doing. And many continue with that. It's just fascinating that then we have these cross-cutting pressures like make everyone job ready. You know, we want students to have jobs and dignifying. But actually, like, you know, there is something about, what is it that Newman calls it, the enlargement that takes place, that is prior.
Yeah. So I guess what we're saying is we should all clean our bedrooms before trying to change the world.
That's right. I should say, when I just had this sudden thought, when I said, Nathan, that Campbell is Don Quixote in Queensland, I meant it like...
He's not senile.
I meant like he's fighting the good fight that nobody else wants to fight, right? Like I said, the only way I find out about these crazy things happening is when I see him write something like this and I go, oh my gosh, and I think, who would ever want to... Oh, I'm glad someone else is spending their time. I'm not going to spend my time with that.
Gosh, yeah. So he's basically the canary in the coal mine for us.
Yeah, there you go.
I guess.
That's a better one. Canary. Yeah.
Well, with that, we're about out of time. Thank you so much for listening to us. As we said, this is the first part of a series on the idea of the university. Please like us on Facebook by just searching the U Catastrophe. Follow us on Twitter. You can find us at UCAT, that's EUCAT _ podcast. Please drop us a review on whatever platform you listen to us. So if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, for example, please write us a review there. We've had some fantastic reviews lately. So at Archbishop of Canterbury said, thank you so much, boys. You're really saving the church.
Yeah.
That David is real handsome.
I'm not going to swim the Tiber now.
Yeah, and good luck to you all. He said, me proud to be Anglican.
He said it's you and Nikki Gumbel HTB. That's the only things I listen to.
Fantastic. Yeah, drop us a review. That'd be fantastic. And we will see you next week. Bye.